You know, this isn't gonna have a happy ending. It's not possible.
Hey, man, we catch him, I'll be happy enough.
If we catch John Doe, and he turns out to be the devil, I mean, if he's Satan himself, that might live up to our expectations, but he's not the devil. He's just a man.
You know, see, you bitch, and you complain, and you tell me these things, and he's mean. If you think you're preparing me for hard times, thank you, but...
But you gotta be a hero. You wanna be a champion. Well, let me tell you, people don't want a champion. They wanna eat cheeseburgers, play the lotto, and watch television.
Hey, how did you get like this? I wanna know.
It wasn't one thing, I can tell you that.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about the movies people love watching. From Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. As always, your hosts are me, Slim, and Gemma. And today our guest is a very special musical artist whom we found lurking on Letterboxd.
I'm so proud of quietly discovering Vagabond all by myself over on Bandcamp, and then one day actually squealing out loud, and everyone in the office was like, what? What's wrong? I was like, I've just discovered that Vagabond is on Letterboxd. Anyway, if you've been paying any attention to me or Bandcamp or NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts or indie music in general over the past few years, you may have heard of Vagabond and the beauty that is songs like Water Me Down or her stunning duet with Courtney Barnett on a cover of Rod Stewart's Reason to Believe. Vagabond is the moniker of Leticia Tamco, and her four Letterboxd faves are big ones this week: Pretty Woman, The Piano Teacher, The Worst Person in the World, and Seven. In the immortal words of Morgan Freeman, Leticia, is this episode going to have a happy ending?
We'll see.
I'm terrified.
Three bangers, at the very least, three bangers of movies. The Piano Teacher might be one that will surprise people this episode, but you got some great picks this week, Leticia. Some great picks. How's it feel?
Thank you. I mean, I definitely think my four picks make me seem demented, but but it's my true personality, so I feel well represented.
This is your true personality. Speaking of which, on Twitter you write, I make music for emo people who like to dance.
yes, sad people who like being sad while dancing, you know. Never meant to be you, never meant to be me, never meant to be us. Never meant for all of this, never meant for you to love, never meant for you to trust. So I'll take my time next. That's the ideal pitch for people to check out your music.
And I feel like another important question is, have you managed to beat Elden Ring yet? What's the status on your Elden Ring playthrough?
You know, I really think my job as a musician is impeding on my success as a as an Elden Ring master, because I'm working on an album, so I've had to really cut down my gaming lately. So no, I have not beat it, but we'll get there. I plan to take it on the road. So
oh, wow. Nice.
There are so many musicians secretly or not so secretly on Twitch, right?
Yeah.
It's just like, so it's like they, this whole other world of, and I'm guessing is it like because you're on tour and you need something to do between soundcheck and the show, or is there some other thing about gaming that links into the musician brain?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. I think it's both. I think it's having an outlet that really is so different from what you do as a job, but still is like a hobby and immersive. It's as immersive as being an artist, being in the studio, being on tour, playing shows, but it's not so linked to your source of income. I think that's definitely part of it.
I just used to knit in the tour van.
Yeah.
I just used to churn out scarf after scarf.
that works too. But yeah, you know, the Switch is so little. You can just be in the van just going crazy.
Letterboxd show officially pivoting to a gaming podcast. Will Gemma recover after this week? So Pretty Woman is your number one currently in your four favorites on Letterboxd. 1990, 3.5 average on Letterboxd. I feel like that's a little low, to be honest.
Yeah.
Just about 2,000 fans on Letterboxd. And the synopsis, for those who don't know, Gary Marshall directed. Who knew it was so much fun to be a hooker when a millionaire wheeler dealer enters a business contract with a Hollywood hooker, Vivian Ward? He loses his heart in the bargain. Gemma, you didn't come up with a better synopsis than that?
I did not. No. I was like, what else am I going to write? I mean, all I was going to say is, you know, in the latest remake of Pygmalion. Which, of course, this is based on, you know, and also My Fair Lady. So basically what we've got is the very, very leggy Julia Roberts at, I think, the height of, or just sort of coming into the height of her fame, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, so what's interesting to me, and so Leticia, you may not know this, but we have Jack listening in the background, and he's otherwise known to listeners as Jack's Facts. So he dives through the Letterboxd stats and prepares data of interest for us. And he writes that this is Gary Marshall's second most popular and highest rated film. Second most? I mean, Pretty Woman's huge. What could possibly be Gary Marshall's highest rated and most popular film?
I don't know.
The Princess Diaries.
Oh my God, another classic. Okay. Wow. Okay, that's
all right.
That's so iconic.
So I'm just gonna start out this conversation with a review from Sophie, which is I completely identify with, of Pretty Woman. The way the feminism leaves my body for over 2 hours whenever I watch this movie. Why is this in your top four? Not only in your top four, but number one in your four faves.
Well, okay. Pretty Woman is by far my favorite movie. If someone asks me what's my favorite movie, and it's not based on maybe some other things people think. It's just like, well, it's just one of the first movies I fell in love with when, like, my family and I moved to the U.S. And I just, and as soon as I signed up for Letterboxd, that was the one that came to mind immediately. Oh, there's a top four. Pretty Woman is in it, of course. So it was like probably the first movie I've ever logged as well. But I just love the it's so funny. It's comedic, you know. It's fun. It's like vintage, and it's like Julia Roberts and. They're trying to convince us that like Julia Roberts is like this like raggedy, haggard, but it's like, I can't believe that Julia Roberts is passed up on in any world, but I kind of love that they're going for that. It makes me laugh. And I love how she transforms into like rough around the edges into, but she's just like Julia Roberts with curly hair and then to straight hair, which is actually not unlike Princess Diaries, where Anne Hathaway goes from curly hair to straight hair. So there's a pattern here from haggard to beautiful. But I just loved everything about like, I just love everything about the plot. I love the looks. I love the outfits. I love just so many good scenes. It's actually where I like heard Prince for the first time. I didn't know that like that bathtub scene was Prince until like that movie. Like I just didn't know. I wasn't aware. So it's also cool because I like learned a lot of songs through movies, and that was like a huge one. And Roy Orbison, like I'm a huge Roy Orbison fan, and to find out that he made the Pretty Woman song, and yeah.
I was thinking that Edward Lewis, Richard Gere's character, I was like, this guy is an asshole. Until that bathtub scene when she's like, don't you just love Prince? And he replies,
I just love Prince.
More than life itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, even if you don't mean that, Edward Lewis, that was the perfect reply.
The one review that was cracking me up today that I was reading on Letterboxd from Emma, y'all on Letterboxd writing essays about the ethics of this movie. It's a rom-com that came out 20 years ago. Honestly, who even cares?
Yeah. I don't. I certainly do not. I do not.
What is it about this film that makes us all forget our feminism for 2 hours? Why are we so on board with this narrative? This is definitely, as you say, one of those films where the wig work is doing a lot of the work in terms of suspending our disbelief.
Yeah.
But it's the central couple, right? It's the Richard Gere, Julia Roberts pairing.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't. I've rewatched it somewhat recently and I didn't cringe really at all. Like I didn't have any moments of like, ooh, that didn't hold up. Maybe there are moments, but really I think she's so charming. Like Vivian as a character is so charming that, and she's so like endearing that it really is. I'm just rooting for her the whole movie. I'm like, yes, get paid. Like, great.
I was trying to figure out if there was a through line, in all of your film choices. And I think I've figured it out, apart from The Worst Person in the World, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But as I started watching them all, I was like, oh, there's a classical music theme running through at least three of these films. And in Pretty Woman in particular, it's that, you know, when he takes her to the opera and she passes the opera test, but he's like, you know, people either completely fall for opera straight away or they slowly come to maybe appreciate it. And he's kind of waiting to see which one she is. But also at the same time, the opera he's making her watch is about a courtesan who ultimately dies.
Yeah.
I'm like, what is wrong with you, Richard Gere? You're sick. You are sick.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's a good point. I love that scene. Oh.
Every time we talk about Richard Gere, I guess I sort of grew up during like Richard Gere's heyday, but man, what a heyday he had. You know, he was just like this suave guy in all these movies, even the ones where he was the man of the night that we talked about for a recent episode.
The American Gigolo. He's
got some kind of suave about him that I think that type of character has really gone out of fashion, right? They don't really make movies with like this kind of Richard Gere, suave, rich guy because that character repulses people today.
Right.
Way back 28 years ago, you're like, yeah, this is pretty fun.
Right. You're like older guy with like gray hair and it was a thing.
I'm interested in Bethany's list on Letterboxd. Films that destigmatized sex and sexuality for me as a woman. And I think one of the things that potentially makes Pretty Woman kind of still work, like not make us cringe 20, however many years on, is that Vivian, you know, you're sort of waiting for the backstory of, you know, the trauma and the abject poverty, you know, all of the reasons and for, you know, that she became a sex worker. And while that story does come, it's sort of not like she was sex trafficked into the job and it's not like she doesn't like the job.
Right.
Like she's quite proud of the job. And I feel like, you know, we had Karina Longworth on the show a couple of episodes ago who does the You Must Remember This podcast. Mm-hmm. Have you listened to that?
I have, yes.
Yeah, and this season is amazing for the journey that she's taking us on through sex in American films in the 80s and 90s and then the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this one, that scene in the ballroom in the hotel on the piano. Oof.
Yeah.
I mean, how much cachet does he have in that hotel or whatever the hell building that is? He just tells people to please leave. I'm about to have sex with this woman. You need to leave this ballroom.
On this grand piano.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's really interesting. I think that's a good point about, you know, Vivian's character doesn't seem to hate it. Like she's not like oppressed or, you know, or feeling, you don't get a certain pain. You just get kind of like a very free person who's just kind of going with the flow. So I think it is, that's part of the reason why it's maybe not hard to watch, really.
Yeah, you know? She has agency. And I think specifically that scene too, he's going down.
Yeah.
You know, it's about her pleasure as much as it is about his.
Yeah.
I think Barney is my breakout star of this movie. Barney the hotel manager.
Oh, yes.
I mean, what a sweetheart. Hotel manager with a heart of gold. They don't exist in real life except for this movie.
Truly. Oh, yeah. All the like the classes that she did or the lessons on the silverware. And the person, I think the villain really is Edward's friend. That,
oh,
like,
George Costanza?
Yeah.
Phil and his miniature billiards table?
Oh. Yeah, like that. He's the gross character.
My note for George is, I actually just call him George. George is scum in my notes. It's sick.
Just that's if that was the bulk of the movie, I think it would be like harder to watch.
If Leticia, you were invited on a limitless credit card shopping spree, would you go straight to Rodeo Drive, or would you in fact go straight to your nearest music gear wholesale store?
What would you do? Good question. I would probably, if those were my two options, I would probably go to Rodeo Drive, because I can probably amass music gear just off of my job. Whereas going to Rodeo Drive doesn't seem like something I would do unless someone gave me an unlimited credit card, you know? It seems like more of a novelty in my world than getting music gear, oddly enough.
This is true. This is true. What was your favorite outfit? Slim.
Good. I don't know. Richard wore some amazing suits in this movie. Yeah. I got to give him some props. He looked great in those suits. That gray suit, man alive.
I loved so many of them. I loved the one where it wasn't the Kentucky Derby, right? But it was like horses.
Yeah, the polo. The
polo, yes. Yeah. I loved that. And I loved the opera look as well.
The polo, so the brown dress, the brown polka dots. Yeah, that was my fave. My favorite outfit. The whole film. So banging. Yeah. And you know what you said about the music in the film? There's a list on Letterboxd by Silent J called Films That Got You Addicted to Songs. And they're absolutely right. Pretty Woman, Roy Orbison. Must Have Been Love. I mean, that is a massive hit. Who was that?
Must have been love.
Roxette. Must have been love, but it's over now. So I'm just going to edit that out.
Oh, God.
Massive.
No, I'm leaving that in. That might start out the show now.
That's a massive, massive tune.
I need a Vagabond cover of it.
Oh, boy.
Now, in your second of your four favorites, Isabelle Huppert, who plays the lead character, says to one of her students, she's a piano teacher, she is the titular piano teacher of the piano teacher, she says to one of her students, Schubert isn't a walk in the park, and frankly, neither is your second of your four favorites.
Yes.
The piano teacher, 2001, Michael Haneke. It has a 4 out of 5-star average on Letterboxd. It is a big film. It won the Grand Prix at Cannes the year it came out. It won Best Actress and Best Actor for the two leads, Isabelle Huppert and a lovely chap by the name of Benoit Magimel. And it also stars the great French actress Annie Girardot as the mother in question of the sexually repressed piano teacher who lives with her domineering mother and meets Benoit, who is known as Walter in the film, who starts romantically pursuing her. The synopsis does not at all get across that this is a psychosexual drama of epic proportions.
The amount of speed that I had to shut this movie off in my living room when my son walked in, I almost hit the button right through the Roku remote. I was like, oh, God.
Leticia, honestly, when I put my very, very short review of this film up, in which I did write, well, she said Schubert wasn't a walk in the park. Someone posted, I have been waiting for this episode because I tagged it Letterboxd Show. And so now I'm scared. I'm like, the pressure is on. Michael Haneke is not for the faint of heart.
No.
Tell us about The Piano Teacher and how it has landed in your top four.
Okay. So Isabelle Huppert is like one of my favorite actresses. And I kind of went down, and I do this every so often. I kind of go down the list of watching like every movie that one actress has done. And I knew nothing about The Piano Teacher before. And I just kind of, the way that I watch films is blindly. Like I don't look up trailers. I don't read the synopsis. I just go into it. And wow, was this day a serious, like, I just walked right into this, you know, made dinner, set up my really nice projector, had just everything. And the whole time I'm just like, what have I, and all my friends who were over, I was just like, yeah, I wanted to watch this movie, has my favorite French actress in it. And they're like, yeah, let's put it on. And everyone's like, what are you doing to us? Like, what? What is wrong with you? And so this film is just, I actually want to rewatch. It's so sick and twisted and epic and amazing. And it's so twisted.
And it's a slow burn, right? Yes. I'd forgotten that I'd seen it. I thought, as I was watching it this past week, I thought, there's moments in this that I recognize, and I realize that it is, you know, I did see it first time round, probably suppressed a whole lot of the scenes in it, but I remember the pocket in the coat scene.
Yeah.
As soon as that was coming, I was like, oh my God, I remember everything now from here on in. But it's a real slow burn, because the character of Walter of the synopsis, the young man who starts romantically pursuing Erica, we don't meet him for, you know, a good 15, 20 minutes. And then nothing happens. Everything happens. There's lots of, you know, eye acting between Isabelle and Benoit. But it's, you know, it takes a long time. I mean, for the first 15 minutes, it's really about setting up our understanding of the relationship between Erica and her mother.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, Isabelle was 48, I think, when she made this film. Looks amazing for 48.
She looks incredible.
Oh my God. And so what we've got here is this brilliant, brilliant musician, a brilliant and quite sort of brutal and cold teacher who's clearly not really been able to get it on with anyone ever anywhere on account of living with this mother who's, I don't know, has issues with her daughter ever wearing anything nice or going anywhere.
You know, don't they share a room or at some point, or like share
share a bed?
Basically share a bed. Yeah. But as Jax Fax writes, he gave us notes to talk about this film with you, and his first note is, have fun. I'm like, I don't think anyone should ever say that to anyone about watching a Michael Haneke film.
Yeah.
But so it transpires, without wanting to get too spoilery, that when Walter starts pursuing Erica, and including getting lessons from her, he's got one idea of the relationship that he might want to have with her. She has quite a different idea.
Come on, how about Walter, my sweet summer child? You don't know what you're getting into,
Walter.
You young
Walter,
bug.
When he's at the recital, when he meets her, the night he meets her, which is at a recital in somebody's beautiful home, and everybody's clapping at the end of the recital, and he's clapping the longest, like he's sitting there going, yeah, 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 to the point where his uncle kind of puts a hand on his arm. He's like, whoa there, whoa there, big boy.
I thought this was a gorgeous, this is the first time I've seen this. Funnily enough, I'm not sure, Lazizia, if you've seen Elle that she was in as well.
No, but that has been on my list.
Add that to your list. Move that to the top of your list. So those are the first two movies of hers that I've seen. And that can create just like, wow, she goes hard in her film. Yeah. She like, you know, taboo goes out the window. She doesn't give a crap.
Wikipedia describes Isabelle as one of the best actresses in the world, and also She is known for her portrayals of cold and disdainful characters devoid of morality. If you, what would you want your 10-word Wikipedia entry to say about you?
The same. I would do anything. I would do anything to be like Isabel.
But there's so many shots in this movie. Like, so that recital you mentioned, I love the shots where it's literally just one take on either character for what looked like three minutes. Like, you don't even get a shot of the other character, even when they speak. Yeah. I thought those were gorgeous. So I'm the same way. I love going into these movies just like completely blind. Like, this just looked like a love story based on the cover. Like, oh, a fun little love story. Yes. Repressed love, a piano teacher. They need love. Right. They only just practice piano 12 hours a day. It's much more than that.
It's so much more. I mean, you should have known from Harry Neff's Letterboxd review where she writes, the next time someone asks me if I'm a feminist, I'm just going to tell them to watch this movie.
It's true. I mean, there is a whole, you know, I've thought about the whole etiquette around recommending this movie. Like, I've given this thought because it changed my life. I love this movie so much. It's one of my favorite. But then I, you know, went to my trusted group chat. I was like, you know, my friends like Artist Mitski and I'm like, you guys have to watch The Piano Teacher. And she's like, oh, welcome. She was like, I didn't know if it was okay to say you should watch The Piano Teacher. And I've recommended it to people and say, just don't read anything, go in blind. And people are always texting me like, why? Also, thank you, but why did you do this to me?
Why and what way did it change your life?
I mean, I think the cinematography is beautiful. Like, all of the scenes, and one, I have so much respect for Isabel's acting. It's so, I mean, you can really see her in her work. And as a non-actress, it's cool to like watch someone act and be like, wow, this, I don't know enough about this, but I know that this is masterful. And I think that that's like, it's beyond talent. It's just watching her. I just believe her in every role that she's done. She's like an unbelievable actress. Like, and that, watching that alone and watching her portray this really twisted but complex character, and the scene in the, and I don't want to be spoilery at all because I want people to watch this, but the scene in the bathtub like wrecked my world. Oh. Like, it was just, you just can't forget. You just can't forget scenes like that with acting like that in a story like that. It was mind blowing. Mm. And I have been wanting to watch it again, but also, are we in the right headspace? I don't know.
I was thinking, I love all of the scenes in which she's teaching, and I love the way that she talks her students through what the pieces mean, what the intention of the composer was. And I was thinking, I just need Isabel Huppert to talk me through every piece of music from now on. Like, I need to put Kendrick Lamar's new album on and have Isabel telling me what's going on rather than Kendrick telling me what, or Twitter telling me what's going on with the album. You know, the way she's like, it's cold, and then demonstrates that on the piano. It's like, oh, it's so good. I also wondered if you love this film because Walter is an engineer who is also a musician.
Maybe, you know, I mean, the whole musical aspect of it was certainly a drawing factor. You know, I was dating someone who's like a composer at the time, and we watched it together, and I knew, like, I knew Schubert through that, and like all this, so it felt like this whole world that just lumped in with everything. It contributes to the beauty of it for me.
But I was like, is it true that you studied engineering?
I did,
And I was thinking about this character who is, you know, he's almost too old to be a music student. And they say so in the film. They're like, why does this guy want to come and study here? He's way too old. He's not going to have a career at this point, which I thought was a bit brutal because you're never too old to be a concert pianist. Right. But, you know, the idea that there's this person who's got this whole other career, but he's got this passion.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's brutal, but also really accurate, right? Because in classical music, especially, it's kind of this thing you do forever, and that's how you're good at it. There are maybe five jobs for it. So to get started late in the game is almost like, but there is a parallel between Walter and I in just, I didn't start making music until I graduated engineering school. So it was this thing of like, wow, I see myself in all of these twisted people.
Plus, Walter thinks he can rock her world. Walter's like, wait until she gets a load of me. And then it's the total opposite, Walter. Walter, you don't even know. You're so young, Walter. You haven't experienced life, my friend.
Oh my gosh.
What is that line she says to him? Never hound the woman you claim to love.
Yeah. Oof.
I mean, I'm guessing you watched this in French. No need for subtitles. But yes. There were lines like, what does he say to her? You've been stuck on my mind like a nut on a bolt. I'm like, oh, right. Walter.
He also says one of the most telling lines, I think, in the movie is, I think something along the lines of, what's in this for me? Which I think is probably the most telling line about how old he is and how he's so far gone from how relationships work at this stage of his life.
The whole you can't leave me like this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, if I had a dollar for every time a dude said that to me in my 20s, I'm like, I can actually. And you know what? So can Isabel, because otherwise, as Zach Hayes writes on Letterboxd, I can't wait for Isabel Huppert to look at me once, killing me instantly.
God.
Oh, that is so perfect.
This was definitely me on this watch from Dead Ringer. Why is Michael Haneke's signature move making me so uncomfortable that I have to keep checking how much time is left in his movies?
It's so true. I mean, it has, I just know that I'll love other, like, I'll love like funny games, but I haven't been able to watch. I'm just like, how are we doing? You just have to go in, you know, you just have to go into it and it will jump rock in your world. And it's okay. You'll process it for a while. And, you know,
speaking of rocking your world though, I just want to say, like I said in the opening, I'd squealed when I saw that you were on Letterboxd because I felt so proud of myself for having quietly gone and discovered you on Bandcamp. And like, you were my little secret that I was, you know, like when you talk about dropping in the group chat, have you seen The Piano Teacher? For me, it's, I've been dropping Vagabond in group chats all over town for the last several years. Like, on board the Vagabond train. So like, stoked to be talking to you. And you're having a great start to the summer so far. You've got a few gigs under your belt already. You've got a Storm King Art Centre show in June. How good does it feel to be back out on stage, back out on the road?
So, I mean, so good. This is what I love doing, you know, most of all. And I, you know, unfortunately put out an album right before COVID. And so everything was canceled.
Unfortunately for you, for those of us isolating at home, playing it on repeat every day. I've got this, I didn't even put the sweatshirt on. I bought your merch. Oh,
that makes me so happy. I mean, yeah, it's exciting to be back on the road and to see the, you know, like, you know, Water Me Down has like 10 million plays, which is crazy. And I'm like, who are these people? I want to see them. And it's nice to be back out and see people like singing the words and like selling out the shows. And so I'm really looking forward to Storm King and it's nice to play amongst the art too. Yeah. So that'll be a special show.
Have you ever been to Storm King, Slim?
No. I mean, it has the greatest name in history. I know that much, but I haven't been there.
It's just a short drive from you. You got to get up there.
After we record, I'm heading up there. As soon as we hit stop on this recording.
No. Go in June when Leticia's there.
I'm going to stay there until June.
Do you want to be in movies? Do you have ambitions?
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. I'm not. People have always told me that I need to do like voiceover work. You need to do voiceover work. You need to do voiceover work. And I love it. A lot of my friends are actors. But I just think that's like, it's in my pipeline. It's only a matter of time. I don't know if I'm a good actress, but someone will just write the thing that's perfect for me.
It's only a matter of time until you're in some feminist rom-com with Patty Harrison.
Exactly. Like, nepotism will get me there. And
an American version of The Piano Teacher coming in 2025.
Yeah. It's like my friend Patty will write a sick and demented script and let me be an extra, maybe.
And you'll score that and I'll film. Score.
That's for sure. They better all have me score their projects. So
yeah, that needs to be in your future.
Yeah,
you also. I mean, this is pretty exciting for me because I'm a massive Courtney Barnett fan as well. Opened for her in 2018 on her North American summer tour. First of all, how freaking awesome is CB?
Yeah, I mean, legend.
We love her. And second of all, out of South by Southwest this year, I saw Danny Cohen's documentary, Anonymous Club. I don't know if you've seen it yet,
but it's coming out.
It's coming out in a couple of months, and I just want to get that on everyone's watch lists. It follows Courtney in 16mm film.
Yes.
During that, you know, that period of time, and it's
he was on the road back in 2018 filming everything, and in fact he was also, I wonder if this is in the, if this made it into the film, but he was there when Courtney came over to my recording studio, which is just a garage that I call a recording studio, in Los Angeles, and when we were recording Reason to Believe.
Oh my god.
Ooh. Yeah,
I just want to say that Slim is in a basement that he also calls his recording studio.
About to make that exact joke. That's funny. Let me say that again. Oh, that's funny you say that, because I call my basement recording studio and it's just this dank ass basement that I'm in right now.
Hey, if it records and you put it out, it's a studio. Like,
thank you. I feel empowered right now. I'm gonna keep saying it.
No, I come from Bandcamp world. Anything could be a studio.
You're fresh from a Disney concert hall show where Liz Phair headlined, mm-hmm. and Liz and friends, including you, reimagined, and I quote from the concert description, the lamest hits of Gen X. What Gen X hit did you reimagine?
I did Linger by the Cranberries.
Oh,
yeah.
God. I bet that was amazing.
Yeah, it was really special. It was cool because, you know, everyone did, I mean, the crowd went up for If It Makes You Happy, Sheryl Crow, that Best Coast did, and Remy Wolf did Loser by Beck. I did Linger by the Cranberries. It was a whole thing.
Are you going to release that?
It's funny. People have been like, you need to release the cover. I'm like, okay, I am almost done with this album. It's like, I just start putting out covers now.
Speaking of Gen X hit, I don't know if there is a bigger one than Seven from 1995. Yeah. David Fincher, written by Andrew Kevin Walker. This is a 4.3 average on Letterboxd.
Okay.
This is like, yes. Is the Letterboxd Hall of Fame a thing? Should we coin the Letterboxd Hall of Fame? This is in
it.
There.
We're doing it right now. Officially. We've just officially opened the Letterboxd Hall of Fame. Leticia from Vagabond, if you could cut the ribbon, we'd be so grateful.
Cutting.
A lot of good marketing opportunities with Hall of Fame. I feel like we need to mentally save that one for some kind of marketing meeting. But 16,000 fans, and this looks like a patented Gemma synopsis. I'm not sure, Gemma, you want to read this one or me?
Oh, you go for it. I wrote it. You can read it.
All right. Let me see if I can do it justice. In this post-Alien 3, pre-Fight Club crime thriller, a soon-retiring homicide detective, the well-read and thoughtful William Somerset is paired with an eager but far more novice transfer, David Mills, to solve one last gruesome case of a serial killer whose crimes are based on the seven deadly sins. This is the big one. I have vivid memories of this, getting that DVD case. I feel like the DVD probably ran out when I started watching this movie. What about you, Leticia? How did this get in your top fave?
Yeah, I watched this for the first time in 2020.
In lockdown?
Yeah, in lockdown, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. People were just like, you would love David Fincher, you would love, and I hadn't seen anything. So this was the first one, and then I started on a whole tirade. But it was just, I mean, the ending is insane. The whole I just love when a movie has me interested for this long and I'm in, you know, like we can skip over the Kevin Spacey of it all, but it was.
Actually, I'm just going to jump in and say, read straight from Jack's facts description. Thank God Kevin Spacey playing a total detestable creep here means he doesn't retroactively ruin it. And that's exactly what I thought.
That's true. That's true.
As himself. So this movie is so memed. Yeah. Memeable.
Yeah.
Did any of that impact your viewing as for the first time in 2020? Or were you able to just kind of sit in and absorb everything for the first time?
Absorb everything for the first time. I'd never heard of this movie before. Never seen anything. Again, didn't read description, didn't see a trailer, hadn't heard of it. All I heard was, you should get on David Fincher since you like twisted, weird, like, weird stuff. And I was like, okay, cool. And I just got in and it similarly, I think going into these, that's the context behind all of my movies too. It's like, I'm going in completely out of, you know, I don't know anything that's going to happen in any of these four movies when I'm watching it for the first time. So I didn't get any of it spoiled for me. I did watch it with a friend who had seen it before, and I would see his face, like he like knew all the scenes, and I would see him like look at me reacting to certain things. So it's like, okay, you're giving it away that something's crazy is going to happen, but that's about it.
This film is in the Letterboxd top 250 of all time at number 95.
Yeah.
And for very, very good reason. It's his highest rated film, Fincher's highest rated film. But of course, in terms of most popular, it sits behind Fight Club, Gone Girl, and The Social Network. But wow, it is a big, big film. And I just looked up that Kevin Spacey stuff, and it seems that actually the story around him is that he didn't want his name listed in the opening credits or mentioned in any of the publicity because he didn't think that the film was going to be any good. And also withholding his name meant that he didn't have to do any of the publicity around it.
Yeah, it's a cool reveal when his character kind of does appear. And right. Jack mentions this is a formative film for him. I mean, countless white men probably can say the same thing around our age. But this movie, I think I've seen this maybe like hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. When I think back on like my earliest movie, like tapes or DVDs that I owned. But this was probably the first time I've seen it maybe like 15 or 20 years.
Wow.
This viewing. So it was so fun to see like gritty David Fincher, like noir, like detective stuff. I'm like, oh my God, yeah, this movie is good. kind of like in my head nowadays, it's like, yeah, seven, whatever, Fight Club, whatever.
Yeah.
But like when you sit down and watch it, like, okay, yeah, dummy, this really is a good movie.
I was trying to work out where it's set because they never say the name of the town or the name of the city. They just talk about, like, especially in the scenes with Gwyneth Paltrow's character, she's constantly talking about, you know, oh, you came here, oh, David Mills, Brad Pitt, your partner, made you move here to this town. I'm sorry about that. And I was like, what is the city supposed to be? So I looked it up and all I know is that it was shot all over LA, but they just had the rain machines on.
Oh my God, the rain.
The whole time to make it look like this kind of, I don't know, is it Philly? Sorry, Slim. No, where is
it? You could say it's New York. I feel like you could say it's New York as well.
Yeah.
You know, the amount of rain in there. I mean, the rain is just so suffocating in this movie.
Totally. Right? And as Sean writes on Letterboxd, it's not a David Fincher film unless there's a thin layer of filth covering every frame.
Mm.
Even the library felt a bit dirty.
No one has cleaned that library in 30 years. Well, Morgan Freeman sit in that dirty
security guards
library.
Are too busy playing cards and listening to Bach.
I was thinking of the DVD set that I had. I feel like I remember there being a collector's box, but the case was one of those notebooks that they uncover. And that was kind of like part of the collector's edition. It's like a legit notebook almost.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You were mentioning, so like thinking about this movie and you were mentioning like you love messed up movies. Have you seen Climax?
No.
You need to add climax to
Wait,
your watch list.
What is this? Okay.
But you need to drop that in the group chat.
I was literally...
Your friends probably have seen climax, I feel like.
Mitski has definitely seen climax.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, this is in French, too.
Oh.
Gaspar Noé.
Okay, watching it tonight.
Gemma, what about you? How was your most recent seven viewing? How did it go for
this
you?
This is my most recent seven viewing was only my second seven viewing. Mm. And I saw it first time round in cinemas in 1995. Wow. I think I went to like week three or week four of the theatrical because all the boys at the college radio station I was working at were talking about it. All those dang white boys, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know, if the 1990s version of a meme. Yeah. And I remember going and watching it and feeling very, let me describe the 90s as someone watching movies and as a baby third wave feminist, single white female, seven, like just lots of gruesome murders, loads and loads of just filth and grime. And I remember the feeling watching it going, I know this is a good film. This is an excellent film, but I don't like it. I don't like any of this, like Seven Deadly Sins, gruesome murder scenario, Silence of the Lambs, like all of them, you know? It was just it was a very icky time to be going to the movies as a young woman. Watching it now, I'm kind of, it's almost like, this is going to sound really terrible, but it's almost like, Disney murders, you know, it's like, really theatrical, gruesome setups of serial killing that in the sort of post-Saw franchise world, I'm kind of back on board with. But what I but what I really love about it, I just love a good reading montage. Like reading is not a very theatrical action, right? But I really, really love when there's a library in a movie, when there's someone like a Morgan Freeman sitting down doing a lot of reading and saying to his, you know, much younger, much worse read partner, Mills, you might want to read a book. to which Mills replies, what does he say? Just because the guy's got a library card doesn't make him Yoda.
He's a nutbag. Just because the fucker's got a library card doesn't make him Yoda.
Also, how about the Cliff Notes? Mills buys those Cliff Notes. He has that cop buying those Cliff Notes. Amazingly dated reference.
That is such a 90s move to get the Cliff Notes.
It's true that you do have to feel kind of safe to watch some of these movies. Like, you have to feel like you do have to feel kind of like, okay, I'm safe here. Nothing. This is a movie. It can't really be too... Or at least for me, it can't really be too real, you know, like it just.
Yeah. Like at least in this, we're not seeing the.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of movies since then, you see the perpetration of the crimes. Mm-hmm. But in this, you don't see the perpetration. You see the, you know, the aftermath, the discoveries of the bodies and then the dicks, as John C. McGinley calls them, doing their investigating. And I sort of appreciate that. I feel like things have changed a lot and each decade as filmmakers are trying to work out how to shock viewers even more.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So I'm really on board with that. And also I think like near the beginning, Morgan Freeman's character, Somerset, what a name though, William Somerset, says, this isn't going to have a happy ending, and gets this new partner, and then the great destroying of that character begins. It is, you know, a singular piece of filmmaking. It really is.
The one other thing too I was going to say was, like, I always make this reference about how I go to my in-laws. They're always watching like TBS, and there's like 90 different CSI shows on at any given time. They have like these elaborate kind of like evidence rooms. They got supercomputers, but like 1995 Somerset, you know, these cops are going to like the shittiest apartments.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like their life sucks.
Oh, yeah.
He's about to retire and it looks like he lives in a hotel room.
Yeah.
And it's like that kind of like shitty life, dingy city, dingy house. I feel like that doesn't really happen anymore. It's kind of like out of fashion. Everyone is kind of like these amazing lofts, these amazing offices. So it was cool to sit back and kind of rewatch that kind of lifestyle for these cops.
Well, from one worst person in the world, the evil crime perpetrator in Seven, to the worst person in the world, which is one of the best films of 2022. Joachim Trier, 4.2 average on Letterboxd. We love this film. We love it so much. Chronicles 4 years in the life of Julie, a young woman who navigates the troubled waters of her love life and struggles to find her career path, leading her to take a realistic look at who she really is. Yet another very boring synopsis that belies what this beautiful film actually is. And I love that you've got a really recent film in your top four.
Yeah,
so tell us about it.
That slot was empty for a long time. I just wasn't sure what to put on there, and I saw this film, and I mean, from the like Scandinavian furniture and interiors, all the wood, to the real, a little too real relationship, especially, I don't know, I saw it and after the movie just had to kind of sit there for a second, and then there was silence between me and the friend that I saw. We were just kind of sitting there for a second, just like, that was a bit too real. it was a bit too real. But yeah, I loved seeing like Julie kind of be a mess and chaotic, and it was frustrating to see a bit, you know, because it's almost like when you watch reality TV or something and you're like, come on, there's so many ways you could have done this. Like, you could have done it this way. You could have done it. You're like talking to the person. But it was refreshing to see like such chaos, because it's also really, it's really relatable, at least to me.
Sydney has a list on Letterboxd. Titled Please God Don't Make Me Turn 30. which I'm sure you could possibly identify with. It's got three films on it. It's got The Worst Person in the World, Tick Tick Boom, and Bo Burnham's Inside. And
wow.
That feels accurate.
Yeah.
This is Neon's third highest rated behind Parasite and Portrait of a Lady on Fire. This movie is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's getting Criterion release like next month. Oh my God, so well deserved. Wonderful. Every scene in this movie is like the most realistic relationship scene in history.
Yes.
I mean, you could write a book about that scene where she goes to that party and meets him and they just like flirt for like 6 hours. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Movie magic.
Yeah. It really is like it's almost like it's something that so many people can relate to, but you just like don't want anyone to know.
Or as Lily writes on Letterboxd, I'm in this photo and I don't like it.
Yes. Exactly. You just don't want anyone to see you like this. No. But it's very real. And it, oh boy. Oh
yes.
Boy.
So many Letterboxd reviews from my friends and people that I know in Discords. Their reviews came in and they're like, I had to think about this for like a week before I even wrote something, because like, how do you express yourself with loving this movie without revealing that like you see yourself in this movie? Not that that's a negative really,
totally.
But some people are just like, it's almost like an uncomfortable realization for them.
Yes.
They're like, oh, this is me.
This is me.
Yeah.
On
yeah.
film.
Yeah. It's like, it's sort of like, I was like, tag yourself. I'm the woman dancing at the catch up and you know, at the cabin, but I'm also the woman lying on the couch because she's 40 and tired, but I'm also the guy who collects, you know, physical media, but I'm also the cartoon character with the X for a butt because he's been censored.
right. I mean, I totally related to like, I want stability. No, I want chaos. No, stability is boring. No, but now I want stability again. Oh, I'm so sorry. I let go of stability. But no, I just want to like go crazy. It's like this. Yeah. It's so good. It's so good.
One of the things I love about this film too is that often when you are watching films, stories about you know, people in their 20s. You don't see a lot of parents, if ever. It's mm-hmm. it's about the friends, it's about the roommates, it's about the workmates. And, you know, our relationships with our parents are so important to who we are, and especially as we get into our 20s and really start to realize that our parents are real people and not just the people who feed and clothe us, you know, whose sole purpose is to look after us. But they were also real people who were also in their 20s once. And I love that that is part of the worst person in the world, and part of Julie's journey mm. is her relationship with her dad, her relationship with her mum, her relationship with her grandmother. It feels really important to have those scenes, and they're only short, but they do so much heavy lifting in terms of who she is at that time in her life.
That's a good point.
I also loved and appreciated the like successful cartoonist. That's never really in like mainstream movies. Like, a cartoonist that is paying bills and successful and respected in certain circles is like, you never hear about that really.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was interesting with them both being artists too, and how that worked into their relationship, and someone being successful and someone trying to figure it out. It was all just so real.
Yeah, totally. There's a funny thing that happens, you know, on Letterboxd. Funny, maybe annoying to a certain brand of white dude who often hits the, you know, report this review button. Anyway, after watching Senior Year on Netflix this week, I thought men shouldn't make movies. But then I remembered this film. And of course, when it comes to the worst person in the world, men absolutely should make movies. I think all I'm trying to say is, I felt very, very, very seen as a woman in this film made by Joachim and Eskil, you know, written and directed by a couple of blokes who just get it. It felt, it just feels full and well-rounded. And, you know, in a film that has, I don't know how spoilery we get, how many people have seen The Worst Person in the World at this point, but, you know, in a film that has some pretty intense fertility scenarios going on, it is just made so sensitively and so beautifully. But also you said it's, you know, it's so realistic, but there's also a bit of touch of magical realism in the center of it. That gorgeous scene that, you know, we shouldn't tell anyone about.
Right, but,
you know, is the moment on the poster, is the one.
Yeah.
I'm all for a moment of magical realism like that.
Yeah.
So we talked about four movies, amazing films in your top four, but what are some movies that you would recommend to people that haven't checked out yet off the top of your head? Can you think of any?
Oh, that's a good question. I love Pixar's Inside Out. I would love to recommend that. I'm trying to like,
you just watched Parent Trap.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. I mean, okay. I'm a Nancy Meyers stan. So I just speaking of interiors, like beige, off-whites, like just
kitchen
islands, marble. It's a thing that just comforts me when I've had like a bad day. It's like Nancy Meyers. So I love the Parent Trap. There's actually a clip of like the Lindsay Lohan character where she's doing the British accent, like going viral on TikTok right now, that I'm obsessed with. It's like, the problem is I have class and you don't, or something.
Well, I've got a very specific question. You watched The Northman.
Oh my God.
You write very accurately, everyone in this movie looked exhausted the whole time. You also write, I have critiques, but you'll have to call me personally for those. Well, while we have you on the line,
on the hot seat.
In the hot seat.
Yes. I mean, okay. Well, I don't know if you'd call this a critique. I'm being just a little bit cheeky. There's a lot of grunting. And there's a lot of like male grunting. It also looked like a metal video, which I was kind of into. Like I was into, but it was
that scene when they're in the hot, and you know, and the heated,
like lava
with the waterfall
thing
in the background, and they're like naked in the hot water. I was like, this is like some velvet painting. This
is hardcore
metal.
It could have been a Slipknot video. But it was a whole thing. But I did think that all of that, there was so much to lead to that like scene, and the scene just didn't, like the final scene just didn't fully it wasn't as rewarding as the journey there would have, like, kind of had me anticipating, you know.
On March 5th, you watched one of the greatest movies ever made. Tell us about Shrek.
Okay. See, when I watched Shrek, I was bullied. I was bullied for not writing a proper review for Shrek. People were texting
By
me like,
whom? Who are these Letterboxd friends?
I will not reveal
we
them.
We should
but
be following and bullying back on your behalf.
I will not reveal them, but I will say they are probably musicians you know and love that have bullied me for not writing a full review for Shrek. I just gave it a
Courtney
star
Barnett,
rating.
Wasn't it? Courtney Barnett, there's your full thoughts on Shrek.
They were like, you cannot just give a star rating to Shrek. You need to tell us what you think. And so you know, I did. I was like, enjoyed it. It was great. I mean, it was my first time seeing Shrek, which is unbelievable. But I've been seeing a lot of people like, wow, they really chose being ogres over being white, which was, it's just, I mean.
That should have been your review. That should have been your review.
It was enough for me to be like, wow, yep, Shrek is just canon. There are lessons to be learned here.
Wow, maybe one day in Shrek 8, Return to the Swamp, they'll be singing Water Me Down as one of their great jukebox pop.
Maybe, that would songs. Be awesome.
Thanks so much to Leticia Tamco, aka Vagabond, for joining us on the Letterboxd Show this week. And thanks to you for listening. Thanks also to our crew, Linda Moulton for booking and looking after our guests, Jack for the facts, Sophie Shin for the episode transcript, Monica for the theme music, and Slim for editing out all my gaffes.
You can find links to all the accounts and lists and other things we mentioned in the episode notes. Be sure to queue up our other podcast, Weekend Watch List. New episodes drop Thursdays with Mitchell, Mia, and me. We love if you felt inspired to leave us a review or rating for our podcast. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production.
That's it. I'm off to read some Marquis de Sade.
Elegance. Any questions?
Can I call you Eddie?
Not if you expect me to answer.
I would have stayed for 2,000.
I would have paid 4. I'll see you tonight.
Baby, I'm going to treat you so nice, you're never going to want to let me go.
3,000 for 6 days. And Vivian, I will let you go.
But I'm here now.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.